You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, July 23rd, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Scott Lemieux on the two conflicting rulings by two circuit courts as to whether or not states that did not set up their own Affordable Care Act exchanges are eligible to provide tax credits to people who purchase insurance on those exchanges. Also on the program today, Cuomo the Lesser apparently may have been involved in something that is vaguely corrupt. We'll see. Maybe we'll have, maybe they'll have to have a new wing at the Tri-State Area Federal Penitentiary just for governors.
Guess one can only hope.
One can only hope. Meanwhile, to show solidarity with people who fly commercial jets, former Mayor Bloomberg heads to Ben Gurion Airport on an El Al flight to protest the FAA's refusal to allow flights into Israel's Ben Gurion Airport because of danger.
I'm on my way, Israel.
All right.
I booked all the first class seats for myself, okay. And I won't have any slops
near
me.
All right, I'm sorry. Let's save the good stuff.
Yeah, we got to do this in the better half.
Yeah. All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I'm also going to talk about Netroots Nation. Didn't get a chance to do that recap in the better half of the program. Thing of note, Netroots Nation 2015 will be held in Phoenix, Arizona, and it has caused a little bit of controversy. Marcos Melitzis, the proprietor of the Daily Kos, out of whom's community Netroots Nation basically grew. It was originally a yearly Kos, as you know, for 2 years. He was never officially involved in the development of it, but it was commenters who wanted to set up a conference where people would meet each other. And about 2 years later, it became Netroots Nation. Marcos announced on his blog 2 days ago, 3 days ago, that he would not be attending the Netroots Nation 2015, nor would Daily Kos provide any support for the conference that year because of Arizona's horrible history of treating Hispanic people like they're second-class citizens. And including SB 1070, some of which a court gutted, but much of which remains, and just the support for people like Sheriff Arapio. Or Arapio, I guess. What difference does it make? We all know the guy's a jerk. And so he said he will not attend. He had two posts on it, one of which announced that, the second of which said, you know, this is a personal decision for me and essentially my entity, but you make your own decisions. But we'll talk more about this in the better half. First, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Scott Lemieux. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Scott Lemieux, he is the blogger from Lawyers, Guns, and Money, and also a contributor to the American Prospect, the Guardian. Welcome to the program, Scott.
Great to be back, Sam.
So, all right, we had two cases yesterday. One was Halbig v. Burwell. The second was it King v. Burwell? I can't quite figure out.
Yes, I've got it right here. It is, I believe it is King v. Burwell, yes.
Yeah, I just chose the first name. There were obviously multiple plaintiffs. And Burwell, of course, is the Health and Human Services Secretary. Both these were at one point v. Sebelius.
Right.
And so let's start with, I guess, let's take this in chronological order. The first case came out of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals,
right.
Which is highly relevant in terms of even a backstory. But first, let's go over the actual case.
Right. Right. So the argument here is that there's a flaw in the parts of the Affordable Care Act that set up the insurance exchanges. So as probably most of your listeners are aware, the Affordable Care Act has three prongs. So it's eventually it wants everybody within 138% of the poverty line to be eligible for Medicaid. Obviously, some people will be covered by their employers. For the people who are in between, that is people who aren't covered by their employers but aren't eligible for Medicaid, the ACA sets up insurance exchanges. So now, obviously, for people who are non-affluent, might not be able to afford insurance. Particularly since the insurance now actually has to cover things, it can't be dropped for people with pre-existing conditions. So the system is set up where people are required to buy insurance, but there are fairly generous subsidies for the non-affluent to purchase insurance.
And
these
are in the form of tax credits, I believe. And
right, that's correct.
This is from 133% of poverty up to 400% of poverty.
Yeah, that's correct. Right. So, and I think that that's about $85,000 a year at the top end, something like that. And so, you know, the literal language of the statute makes it seem as if these credits are available only on state exchanges and not on federal exchanges. So what happened is that, you know, the ACA is kind of a sop to, you know, some conservative Democrats in the Senate whose votes were needed, you know, gave the states sort of the first option of establishing these exchanges. But Congress correctly anticipated that there would be a lot of resistance at the state level, if not quite as much as happened. So it allowed the federal government to step in and create exchanges where the state government wouldn't. So if you, there's a phrase in isolation that if you read it in isolation makes it look like the subsidies are available only on the state exchanges and not on the federal exchanges. So a suit was brought essentially arguing that the federal government has to stop issuing the tax credits you know, to people who obtain insurance on federal exchanges. The IRS, however, has rejected that interpretation. So the case came up because the IRS issued a rule saying, of course, Congress intended to, the tax credits to be available to both. That, you know, when it said state exchanges, you know, obviously the federal government was establishing state exchanges. So that's essentially the conflict, that conservatives are arguing that the credits are available only on state exchanges. The IRS argued that they should be available to both.
And in this instance, the theory of the plaintiffs was, if I'm not mistaken, was that Congress set it up this way because they wanted to cajole states into basically setting up their own exchanges. And therefore, by saying that these tax credits are only available to states that establish their own exchange, this would cajole, I guess, presumably, according to the plaintiffs, the theory was that Congress had was that it would cajole every state to do this, which, I mean, that's their legal argument, right? I mean, that is it that they don't even have to argue as to what the intent was?
Right. Well, there's two arguments. I mean, I just kind of wrote about this, Lawyers, Guns, and Money, but there's two potential arguments. To me, the slightly less bad one is to say that maybe Congress intended for the subsidies to be available on the federal exchanges, but that's not what they wrote. So tough luck. You know, whatever the results that are produced, you know, we have to read the language literally. Now, for reasons we might get into, I think that's a really bad argument, a really bad way of reading the statute, but I can sort of understand that. But the argument you describe, I've actually seen from more people, that they're conservatives arguing that Congress actually intended for the subsidies not to be available on the federal exchanges. But the argument just collapses on itself because, you know, if Congress assumed that all the states would go along in establishing exchanges, why would they bother to give the federal government the power to create exchanges in the first place? And in addition to that, why would they have initially structured the Medicaid expansion so that, you know, states, you know, had to get the, you know, take the expansion or lose all their funding? Everything about the way the ACA was structured assumed that some states would not go along, which, when you saw the Republican opposition, I think was pretty obvious.
Right.
You know, that I'm not sure that they anticipated the scale of it. I would guess that probably, you know, congressional Democrats might have thought there would be 35 state exchanges rather than 19, but nonetheless, they obviously anticipated this problem. So to argue that Congress, you know, but I think that the other
fundamental I should add, it's also not just a function of whether or not there is a hostile, you know, a hostile state legislature or governor to the setting up of state exchanges, but in fact that there are some states that simply just didn't feel like they could get their act together to do it.
Yeah, that's a great point, too, that unlike the Medicaid expansion, which is an exclusively Republican thing, that some states, you know, there are states that were perfectly supportive of the ACA that just were unable or unwilling to set up their own exchanges. So that's 100, yeah, that's entirely correct. And again, something was foreseen. And to me, the really strange thing about the argument that you describe is that Republicans seem to think that the primary purpose of the subsidies was to provide incentives for state governments. But that's, you know, the primary purpose for subsidies was was to enable people to get medical insurance. You know, that it's that, you know, the people seem to be losing sight of the fact that the Affordable Care Act was not written by Republicans. It was written by people who wanted to increase access to medical care.
Right.
It wasn't like an obscure states' rights minutia thing. And it's just so that, you know, it's just, it's bizarre to me watching Republicans try to get in, you know, try to, you know, understand the goals of the Affordable Care Act. As I wrote today, it's like watching an elephant try to play a toy piano. Like, they sort of try to understand, but they can't really do it. It's not really,
well,
they,
it's
they
also,
really know what's going
I
on.
Mean, I think, you know, you may give them more credit than I do in terms of being genuine and sincere in that analysis. I mean, because the theory would have to go something like this, right, that we're going to cajole the states into offering subsidies. Otherwise, their citizens will be forced to buy health insurance. They won't get subsidies. They'll look at the other states that have exchanges. They'll be upset. They will take it out on the politicians in that instance, which, of course, flies in the face of every decision by every state governor that rejected the Medicaid expansion.
Yeah, right. And the Medicaid expansion is much stronger because, you know, the states have really no direct incentive to set up their own exchanges, whereas the Medicaid expansion, they're literally leaving huge amounts of money on the table, and they're still not taking it. You know, so the idea that, you know, that, oh, well, you know, some, you know, if some, you know, constituents are getting screwed, then states will have no choice but to go along, you know, that doesn't make any sense. And there's also no evidence that that was the theory of the drafters of the ACA. Again, if that was the theory, I can't explain why they had the provision to allow the federal government to set up exchanges at all. Wouldn't the better way of, is just saying there are state exchanges and either the states set them up or we don't? Like, but that's not what Congress did. So the theory just has, you know, and so I want to be clear about this. I'm not saying that we should be governed by what legislators subjectively intended rather than what they wrote. What I'm saying is that you have to look at a statute as a whole. You know, you can't look at isolated phrases of the statute. You have to read them in context. And everything about the structure of the Affordable Care Act suggests that the D.C. Circuit is wrong. It just doesn't make any – it just – reading it that way is just contrary to the basic structure and the basic goals of the legislation.
All right,
it's just a senseless reading.
Okay. Well, just to reset here, the court found which argument did they rule on? In other words, did they say it's clear the intent was this and that's why they set it up, or was it did the court find that, like, look, we're not in a position, and it seems to me this is their argument, we're not in a position to divine what Congress wanted. And or we can't tell what Congress wanted, so we just have to go by the strict construction, the what the text itself says in this one sentence.
Yeah, they just basically the opinion sort of, although, you know, they kind of hinted at some reasons why Congress may have wanted to do that. They were essentially agnostic on the question, that they sort of, so whereas some pundits have said Congress may well have intended this, they just sort of said, you know, that, you know, we at least can't assume that that's what Congress wanted. So I would say that they were more the latter, that they were just kind of agnostic, saying that, you know, we're not quite sure what Congress wanted to do, but basically the plain language of the statute says only on state exchanges, and there's not enough evidence to overcome that. So that they didn't really have to make a strong argument about intent. They basically assumed the burden of proof was on the government, and the government failed to make it, which is sort of a striking contrast with the Fourth Circuit opinion.
All right. Well, yeah. Let's go to the Fourth Circuit, because it seems to me that the D.C. Circuit said there's no real indication of congressional intent, whereas the Fourth Circuit said the intent was unclear, but because it's ambiguous, it's going to defer essentially to the IRS's interpretation of the statute. Is that
right?
A fair assessment?
Yeah, so there were two arguments made by the Fourth Circuit. So the majority opinion, yeah, so that they relied on what's known as the Chevron doctrine, based on a sort of administrative case. And what that doctrine is that if, you know, an administrative agency issues a ruling, the court should defer to it unless it is plainly wrong. So the majority, the unanimous panel of the Fourth Circuit, they all said essentially that, you know, the federal government's interpretation is at least plausible. And the majority said, we think that the government's interpretation is probably better than that of the plaintiffs, but they said it was close, but that essentially that if it's ambiguous, then you have to err on the side of the federal agency. So that, according to the Fourth Circuit, had the IRS ruled the other way, it would have deferred to them on that, but since the IRS interpreted the statute in a way that was reasonable, then you have to defer to that. So whereas the D.C. Circuit saw the burden of proof being on the government, the Fourth Circuit saw the burden of proof of being on the people attacking the legislation, essentially saying you have to show clearly that the interpretation was wrong, and if you look at the, you know, statutory provision in context, then it's not clearly wrong. It's at the minimum plausible. So there was also a really interesting concurring opinion, which basically said that was actually being too generous to the lawsuit, essentially that, in fact, it is completely clear that the subsidies were supposed to be available on the federal level, that it's not even ambiguous, that if you just look at the structure of the statute, it's obvious that, you know, that when the federal government established, you know, exchanges for the states, those were effectively state exchanges, that there are plenty of other parts of the statute that assume that the subsidies will be available to both. There's nothing to contradicts that, so that he almost went further than that, just saying that this isn't even a close question, that, right, you know, essentially, that, you know, it's obvious that the IRS's interpretation was right. The rest of the panel was a little more circumspect. They said, well, you know, reasonable people can disagree, but if reasonable people can disagree, you have to defer to the IRS's judgment.
All right, let's take that. I mean, the argument that it's quite obvious. I mean, even the notion of established by the state, I'm not even sure what that means, in the sense that, like, as far as I know, when you go to your state's exchange, it is not clear that it is being administered by the federal government. I mean, did anybody sort of tackle that question of what it means to establish an exchange on which is basically a website? I mean,
yeah, that was kind of central to Justice Davis's concurrence, the Fourth Circuit concurrence, basically saying that the structure of the legislation makes it obvious that when the federal government, you know, establishes an exchange, they're doing it on behalf of the state, you know, that it's effectively still a state exchange, that the federal government is taking some of the administrative responsibilities, but essentially they're all state exchanges. As you say, whether it's federally or state administered, states are going onto, you know, citizens of the state go onto the marketplace. It's set up only for their state. It doesn't cross state lines. There's no effective difference. And so that's what exactly, that if you look at that established, you know, the exchange is established by the state government, you just have to look at it as, you know, whoever does the administrative work, that's what's meant. It's, you know, the exchange that the state citizens go on. So there's just no reason, you know, and so now obviously in isolation, you know, you could read it either way, but, you know, in the context of the statute as a whole, it's just blindingly obvious what it means.
And that's one of the things that struck me about the D.C. Circuit's holding is that at one point, find that quote. At one point, I'm not sure if it was Griffith or the other judge. We will talk about the sort of the fact that it was just a panel from that court. But they said that we're not in a position because we want to take this language as it is, because we don't want to be in a position of changing the intent of Congress when they wrote this statute. And so they're trying to, it seems to me that this is sort of like, this is pretending not to be activist in the way that they talk about being activist, but in fact is very activist in that they are, it seems to me, clearly thwarting Congress's intent, but they are arguing that we are simply in a position of upholding Congress's intent. Like, yeah, acknowledging that this was a mistake. They're saying that this was a very specific use of language, and therefore we're holding out the intent. But that's theoretically, if you're going to isolate one sentence from an entire statute, you could also just isolate one word and try and divine the intent from that one word, right?
Yeah, it's just that I'm glad you talked about that, because those last passages in Grievous's opinion, this sort of folk, you know, oh, we know millions of people are going to lose their insurance, we're really reluctant, but, you know, we have no choice but to be restrained and uphold the will of the legislature. I mean, it's just, as one commenter at our site said, it's sort of like, you know, the judge in Caddyshack saying that we didn't want to sentence all those teenagers to death, but he felt that he owed it to them. Sort of the same thing, you know, it's just ridiculous. You know, to try to say, so this idea that he's upholding the will of Congress over the administrative branch is just, you know, remarkably right. disingenuous.
Right. Here's the quote. Here's the quote that you actually pull. The majority writes, our ruling will likely have significant consequences, both for the millions of individuals receiving tax credits through the federal exchanges and for health insurance markets more broadly. But it's our job as ensuring that policy is made by elected politically accountable representatives, not by appointed life tenure judges. I mean, when you say that, it implies that what you need to do is dig into the intent of the statute. And no one could possibly imagine that was the intent if you did no investigation of the intent. But it seems that everybody involved in the drafting says that's just a patently absurd. Why would we write in a poison pill to our own legislation when the stated goals are quite obvious?
Yeah, here's the thing. The people who voted for the Affordable Care Act wanted the subsidies and the exchanges to work. They didn't want them to fail. That's, you know, and that's why what's amazing about this is that allegedly the courts are upholding the will of Congress, but if anybody can identify any support of the Affordable Care Act inside or outside Congress who accepts this interpretation, that's the first one. You know, like, there's nobody believes this who doesn't hate the ACA, and it's not surprising since, you know, it's just hostility to the idea of insuring people is just embedded within all these arguments, that they sort of assume that Congress wanted these exchanges to fail for something having to do with state power or something like that. But that's not how anybody who supported the Affordable Care Act thinks. That's not their priority. That, you know, that it's just basically a big case of projection. That essentially, you know, we don't care about uninsuring people. We care about making, you know, a bunch of stuff about federal and state power. So obviously that's what the supporters of the Affordable Care Act cared about. It's just sort of standing, you know, as I said, it's literally interpreting the law to defeat its own purposes.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's basically it. You'd have to, I mean, I hate saying this stuff because it's so often misused, but this flies in the face of common sense in the most fundamental way. Like, I hate the use of the words, you know, it's not a common sense ruling, but this really does. I mean, this really is just, this is bizarro world where supporters of the Affordable Care Act would, I mean, because no one anticipated that every single state would set up their own exchange. No one at any point during all of this. And so basically Congress would have had to have written a law where they would have specifically excluded at least one segment of the population, which makes no sense to do this at all.
Right. Yeah, I mean, exactly. It's just what the argument can't explain is why Congress bothered to give the federal government the power to set up exchanges. You know, if they wanted anything done with the states, like, that just doesn't make any sense at all. That the only reason to give the federal government that power is if you want them to be able to set up the same exchanges that the states otherwise would have. There's no reason to give the federal government the power to do something that everybody concedes won't work. It just doesn't, you know, it's just, you know, and as I said, it's not, you know, I think the concurring opinion, the Fourth Circuit put it very well. This isn't really a debate about, you know, textualism or purposivism or, you know, like, no good way of reading statutes would reach this conclusion. You know, everybody on some level is a textualist, but that doesn't mean that you just look at random isolated phrases. You know,
right.
Any competent reading of a statute looks at it as a whole. So you might call that common sense, but it's just basic. There's just 101 statutory interpretation. You know, you don't, you know, focus on individual phrases. You try to make sense of it. You know, how does this relate to, you know, the other passages? How does this relate to the stated goals of the legislation? And the basic way around that of the people applauding this decision is to substitute their own goals and their own priorities from the authors of the legislation. But that can't work.
You have to
infer the intent from the legislation, not from your own views.
And this is so obvious. I mean, this is also, like, I mean, this is sort of like a basic tenet of even, like, contract law, too, right? I mean, you could have
right.
provisions that may that may contradict each other. And so you try and look at what the intent, or what the sense is, what the two parties had an understanding of. And in this case, it's quite clear what, at the very least, Congress had in its mind. All right, so let's talk about Ian Mailhiser has done a very good job of that, and you mentioned in your piece, of introducing us to these two Republican George Bush appointed judges. Who
I should mention one by Bush pair and one by Bush son, but yes, but both by a George Bush.
Right, and maybe the next one will be from Jeb. Who knows? But down the road. But I mean, before we get to that, I did have one more point about the Chevron,
sure.
the citation of Chevron in the Fourth Circuit. One thing to note, and I don't think it would be that much of a problem because we're that much further down the road, but when President Cruz gets into office, he could very well say to his newly appointed director of the IRS, who I don't know, maybe it's Daryl Issa, hey, you should revisit whether or not those tax credits, right, are valid for the state exchanges, right? Under the way that the Fourth Circuit ruled, at least in the majority.
Yeah, and that's one, always where, when a few people were trying to argue that the 2012 election didn't really matter, one argument was, the Democrats might control the Senate, so you can't really do anything to the Affordable Care Act. And what people don't understand is that there's all kinds of things a president could do to hobble the Affordable Care Act administratively, that if you're determined to do it. Now, the only difference may be that, I would say that the more entrenched the Affordable Care Act becomes,
right,
the harder it would be for President Cruz to do that. And one thing here, one difference between this and Medicaid is that, the people who get eligible for these tax credits are not rich, but they're middle-class people. We're not dealing with, the sort of poorest, sort of least politically powerful elements of society. So the more and more people that come to rely on this, it would be tougher for a president to just say, and more people get the insurance. It'll be tougher for a president to say, whoops, you 20 or 30 million people, no insurance for you. That, that it's sort of, that it's one thing in a conservative state, but a president who has to appeal to a national constituency. So it could still happen, but it's a lot easier for the Republicans if the courts do their dirty work for them.
Indeed.
Nobody can be held accountable. A president could do that, but there really are political disincentives. And again, the political disincentives get more and more the more this legislation becomes entrenched, that just like Social Security, that a lot of conservatives have wanted to get rid of it, but the more constituents that rely on it, the harder it is. So I do think that's a concern, but, the longer it goes, it's much harder for a Republican president to do that than it would be for the courts to do that.
Right.
The best way to make it work is to have the judiciary do it.
So let's look forward and see if the courts will do what President Cruz would be hesitant to do. So now there is a three-person panel. Now, the interesting thing about this is that I guess it was like 6 to 8 months ago, the Republicans were refusing to confirm any nominees to this court because they felt that because the full court has 11 members, they felt that was too many. They're really,
right.
They're just sitting around. They're not doing enough work. We could save some money, I guess, or whatever it is with the three judges. Right. So they didn't want to confirm any of them. And then the Senate Democrats finally decided, hey, maybe we should reform the filibuster so that we can actually fill some vacancies. They did. Those nominees were confirmed. There are now 11 judges on that court, and that has huge implications going forward. Tell us.
Right. So one thing is that, that it's enormously that assuming that the administration petitions for what's called an on-bank hearing, that is, a hearing in front of the entire D.C. circuit, what would happen is that you'd have those 11 plus the two senior justices who are part of this panel. So it'd be, I believe, an 8-5 Democratic advantage. And again, as we've already discussed, essentially nobody who is not a conservative Republican is going to be persuaded by these arguments. So if it goes to an on-bank panel, thanks to the Senate funding finally, you know, abolishing the filibuster on these appellate nominees, you know, that it's almost certain that this ruling will be overruled. And that's significant because if that happens, the Supreme Court could just decide not to hear the case. As it stands now, the Supreme Court would almost have to hear it because you have a circuit split.
All right. So yeah. No. Explain that to people. because I think the layperson doesn't understand the implications of a circuit split.
Right. So the key here is that one of the areas in which the Supreme Court is most likely to agree to hear a case is when circuit courts disagree about the interpretation. So that if every court, you know, to have heard the case, every court of appeals to have heard the case agrees, then the Supreme Court only has a reason to intervene if it thinks somebody is clearly wrong, you know. But other than that, it can just let it stand. But generally, when it comes to major legislation, the courts are reluctant to allow one circuit to rule one way and one circuit to rule the other way because that creates a lot of confusion. You know, what's the law going forward? Because remember, there are, 31 states that have federally administered exchanges. There's going to be lawsuits, and all these courts are going to try to have to evaluate, which argument do we think is more likely to buy. So if there's a split, the Supreme Court can't really let that stand. If, on the other hand, both the D.C. Circuit and the Fourth Circuit could have said, the IRS ruling is sound, the Supreme Court could just decide we don't really want to deal with this, so that's one possibility. So that as it stands now, the Supreme Court would almost have to intervene, but assuming that the D.C. Circuit overrules this panel's ruling, then the Supreme Court may just decide to stay out of it. Although I would say that under those circumstances, if the Supreme Court takes the case, that's not a good sign.
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, and that's the thing here too. Is right that we know that the era in which I think people were naive as to just how sort of, ideologically driven a court can be is long since gone. And so this court, if they felt, I mean, it's interesting because Roberts at least likes to have some type of fig leaf to pretend that he is actually that balls and strikes umpire that he promised as he would be. And few believed, or at least, unfortunately, the ones who voted on it did believe or wanted to believe. It would make it much harder for him to maintain that fig leaf to accept this case if the full court basically ruled in consistently with the Fourth Circuit. However, doesn't it only take four justices to grant certification? And we know who those four justices would be, right? I mean,
well, it's tricky because the one thing about granting cert is that you only want the court to take the case if you think you're going to win. So one thing that makes it tricky is that you're right that you only need four, but you only want to take the case if you think that you're going to get a favorable outcome. So in some sense, it requires the sort of, three liberals on the court, the four liberals on the court who will clearly vote to uphold the IRS rule, and there are three conservatives who I think would be guaranteed to vote to uphold the current D.C. Circuit panel, Scalia, Thomas, and Alito. So it's really about how those blocks perceive Roberts and Kennedy as being likely to vote, so that you'll only get four people agree to hear the case if they think they'll get a favorable outcome.
Right. Sometimes people make miscalculations. I mean, there's a lot of theory that Alito made a miscalculation in terms of Harris v. Quinn, right? And this is the the ruling about the fair share payments, and everybody assumed that he thought he could get a greater majority to actually strike down fair share payments, as opposed to having to sort of like technically decide, well, these people just aren't eligible. Eligible to be held to that standard. All right. Well, then let me also ask you this. How would, if the Supreme Court ultimately takes this case, how could they reconcile the idea of what they did with the Voting Rights Act? Because it seems to me that during the Voting Rights Act, when they gutted Section 4, which was the calculation of who's already subject to preclearance by the Department of Justice. And this was a law that was reauthorized as late as, I think it was 2006 or 2007. Yeah. And Scalia actually said, I think it was Scalia said, look, it is just too hard for these senators to vote against you know, the interests of black privilege, or however he phrased it.
Right.
And so we're going to send it back to them. I mean, completely reversing, I mean, the intent of Congress there. How could he then say, well, it was the intent of Congress here, despite the fact that it's going to have bad implications? I mean, how would he reconcile that? Or did he just say, you know, F it. I just watched Fox last night, and I don't need to reconcile, you know, crap.
Well, I guess they can reconcile pretty easily in saying that both those decisions would reflect an essential contempt of Congress. You know, that basically does not taking, you know, that Shelby County is just kind of a remarkable decision in a lot of ways. As my colleague said, it's the worst opinion he's ever read, and he's read Bush versus Gore.
Right.
You know, that it really is just, like, I still, having read it several times, don't understand why it was unconstitutional or what part of the Constitution was violated, but it really just reflected essentially that, you know, Congress held all these hearings and came to a formula, and we don't care. Like, that doesn't sound good to us, and we're just going to substitute our own policy judgment, and this would effectively be the same thing. You know, that rather than trying to understand what Congress is actually trying to do, you just read that isolated phrase, you know, you know, interpret it based on your own goals and your own priorities, and just essentially, you know, throw out the will of Congress in the name of upholding the will of Congress, which is the really remarkable twist about this, that pretending that you're upholding Congress over the executive branch when you're actually doing no such thing, you know, when they're trying to work together to make the law work. So, you know, and that's why I know most court watchers think that the Supreme Court would vote to uphold the IRS rule and not eliminate the exchanges. And they may very well be right. I can see an argument that if Roberts wanted the Affordable Care Act gone, he would have done it in 2012 before people came to rely on it. So, but having said that, it's just I just can't be as confident. You know,
right.
I don't know what they're going to do, because I just don't put anything past this court.
Right.
I
in 1999, the idea.
Shelby County, I don't see how you can.
Right. In 1999, Bush v. Gore was sort of, right. I mean, would have been shocking to the conscience of. Nearly, never mind ideological stripes, I think would have been shocking to conscience of just about everybody who followed that stuff.
Right.
All right, so lastly, let me just finish with this, because that change in the filibuster rule that the Senate right. Democrats had, it could play out in such a huge, huge manner, it seems to me. We should say that since that time, there has been a lot of judicial appointments, right? I mean, it was incredibly effective, not just in this instance, but across the board.
Yeah, that was really, and I was, you know, this goes back a long way, that I was arguing, you know, that the Democrats should have filibustered Alito, not because they thought they could have stopped them, but because basically the Republicans would have used the nuclear option, eliminated the, you know, and then at least eliminated the filibuster on executive and judicial branch appointees. And I think once you do that, you sort of put the filibuster in general on the road to extinction, so that, you know, you think about how different things would have been in 2009 if, you know, Obama had more leeway over appointments, and perhaps, you know, Democrats could have gotten frustrated enough to just eliminate the filibuster altogether. So it was belated, but it's good that, you know, finally, and I think the D.C. Circuit thing really came to a head, is that there's some, even liberal Democrats like Pat Leahy, you know, not necessarily, conservative Democrats, are just very attached to Senate traditions.
Right.
But it was the Republican announcement that it's not that we object to any of these one nominees, but we're in principle opposed to Obama making any more appointments to the powerful D.C. Circuit because we control it. So I think they just said enough is enough.
Right.
Trying to play these gentlemanly rules in a context in which it's not about individual candidates, but just we don't think that the President of the United States should be able to use his appointment power. You know, that just wasn't, you know, even though we don't even control the Senate. You know, so I think that was really important. That you know, and I think that might have actually been a miscalculation on McConnell's part. Now, maybe he had good reason to think that he would get bailed out again, but, you know, at some point it was going to break. You know, that, and I never thought that Reid was the reason the filibuster wasn't abolished. I think that Reid he doesn't act until he has the votes. You know, he's smart
right.
that way. I think it was much more about Leahy and a few of the sort of older guard Democrats who just didn't really want to abolish the tradition.
Right, the institutionalists.
So that is actually a very
right.
significant thing, because, as I said, without that, you know, the D.C. Circuit probably upholds this ruling and the Supreme Court has to take the case. And I think the best case scenario is the Supreme Court not touching this. You know, I just don't want anything to happen.
Do you have a sense, and you know, we got to wrap up here, but do you have have a sense that when they were making this argument that 11's just too much on that court, which I just found hysterical, that they were actually thinking, you know, I mean, that, you know, maybe they didn't think they would succeed in that argument, but that they were actually thinking like, hey, this case is coming down the pike. We may not want 11 justice. We may not want the government to be able to go to this court en banc and win.
Yeah. Well, and that's because the D.C. Circuit is, you know, and some of your listeners may not know this, is hugely important because it hears these kinds of administrative law cases. So, for example, you know, when there's a legal challenge to the new EPA regulations, right, it'll probably go through the D.C. Circuit. So, you know, that it's a very important court, especially since there are a lot of opinions that the Supreme Court doesn't review, so that it really makes a big difference how, you know, so that particularly in modern government where so much policymaking is done by the executive branch, who controls the D.C. Circuit is hugely important. So that was a really high-stakes battle that the Republicans just wanted, you know, they had a Republican advantage on that circuit, and they wanted to keep it that way until there was another Republican president. So it was a real high-stakes battle, and I think that's what finally motivated Senate Democrats to say, enough is enough. You know, that's just, we're not going to allow the serial obstruction of nominees to the circuit, including, you know, very moderate, very qualified. It's just that we're not going to tolerate that. And this could have really big consequences, because, again, 3 years ago, this panel would have been upheld. Now it's almost certain not to be. I'd be willing to wager a substantial amount of money that this opinion is vacated by the en banc. Like, it's not going to persuade anybody who's not a conservative Republican.
And it's impossible to imagine the administration wouldn't appeal. Now, let me ask you this. Is there it wouldn't appeal to the entire court, but is it possible that that in some way the plaintiffs could take this directly, could seek certification from the Supreme Court before the entire D.C. Circuit Court could hear it, or no?
You see, I'm not 100% sure, but, you know, I sort of was trying to research that this morning. I mean, normally I would think that the Supreme Court, you know, would do
wait.
That only if the losing party was petitioning for cert. But so I think that it would have to come down to, you know, if the Obama administration decides it wants to go right to the court. But I don't know why it would do that. I guess the Supreme Court could sort of grant cert anytime it wants. So I suppose that, you know, if the you know, the plaintiffs were just to appeal directly to the court, they could take the case. But my understanding, if I understand correctly, is that would be highly unusual, that they would generally let the process play out. That, you know, that if the loser wants to forgo an on bank, that's fine, but they generally wouldn't do it because the winner wants to avoid an on bank. But I don't think there are any rules that would forbid that. It's more about good practices. It's a tricky question. So I'm not, you know, if somebody disagrees with me, then defer to their judgment. Use the Chevron doctrine. but that, my understanding is that they could, but it would be unusual.
All right.
If I understand correctly.
Scott Lemieux, thank you so much for this great breakdown, and just a fascinating story to see the implications of what that filibuster reform did this far down the line. It's a great sort of illustration of the impact of something like that.
Yeah, a lot of different themes of the last 4 years in politics coming together yesterday.
Indeed. Scott Lemieux, Lawyers, Guns, and Money. We'll put a link up to your piece in The Guardian and, of course, to your blog. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Sam. Talk to you again soon.
All right, folks. That, you know, that story is, I think if there is a quintessential Sam Cedar story, that's pretty close. I mean, if it involved Social Security, I think that would have been...
If some of the subsidies could be connected with delivery through the Postal Service.
That's right.
I mean, then that just would have been.
It would have been
overwhelming.
If it was that case where the post office, was it eligible to provide your Social Security payments? I don't know. I guess that would have been it. And the plaintiff was Walter Block. I think that would have basically been it.
And at the end, Chris Christie goes to jail.
That's right. But we're
and
gonna
then
take a
kid
break.
In his basement calls you to challenge you on freedom.
All right, folks. We're going to take a break, and we're going to talk about I don't think Andrew Cuomo is going to go to jail for this. But the real question is, will this hurt him in the Democratic primary? We're going to try and get Zephyr Teach out on in the next couple of days. Been meaning to do that, and now even more to talk about. We're going to take a break. We'll head into the better half where we will have Fusion? Yeah. Oh, I didn't realize. Jorge Ramos will explain to Bill O'Reilly what a D-bag Rick Perry is. Oh, you never got that Rick Perry audio.
I didn't find it.
He went up and he was talking about how Rick Perry. Well, we'll talk about it in the funner half. And of course, Steve Ducey and Brian Kilmeade are just outraged that Spanish speakers could receive any assistance from the police.
And Ralph Peters, Obama's afraid.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Obama's afraid.
Well, we've got
afraid.
All that. So we've got plenty to talk about.
I just really want to talk about Bloomberg. That's
and
I
then we'll
do.
Talk about Bloomberg. We've got a lot to talk about.
I'm flying over Sam Cena's slob new house in
save
Brooklyn.
It. We got to save it. We got to save it for the better half because we're gonna go. I think we're gonna go all out on this one.
It could be 45 minutes of Bloomberg mocking coming up next. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can also IM us at Majority FM. You can IM us through the app. If you haven't gotten our free app yet, I don't know what is wrong with you. Even if you don't have, I mean, if it's, we have it for iPads. We have it for Androids. Tablets and phones. We have it for iPhones. It's free. It's free of advertising. If you're a member, you can log in and get over. We are coming very close to 1,000 shows. You can have access. I don't know. Let's just call it 950 right now, but I think it's a little more than that. 950 shows, they don't all download to your thing. You can choose to download them directly to your phone if you want, but it just basically gives you a link to stream them, and it's searchable. So in those rare occasions where Michael does properly tag and mention what's in the show, what I've talked about or what we've talked about, you can search it by just putting a term in. And now, we don't have a function to search guests because Michael's only a year and a half behind on that. But apparently, I've been promised that it's happening in June of 2013. During the break is when he's really going to catch up in June of 2013. But it's all searchable and it's completely free. And I think you get 40 shows on the freebie thing to search. On the app, you can obviously call in, one touch button. You can IM me. You can listen to it live. You should get the app. And you should also support this program. We've had a lot of folks have had to cancel their payments because of financial difficulty. So if you're one of those people who's not experiencing any financial difficulty and you listen to the program 2-3 times a week, why not become a member? Make sure that we can continue doing the free show. And also, as a bonus, you get the members hat, too, if you want it.
I mean, if you like what we're doing here and you want to see it grow, we're already talking about different ideas, throwing different things out there, figuring out what more content we can give you all. But we just can't
also,
do it.
It's not even a matter of it growing as much as it is you know, sustaining this program.
At the bare minimum, of course. Yes.
So become a member today at majority.fm. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Get a 10% discount with the coupon MAJORITY. Also, get the Majority Report blend. I think we get a little kickback on that. And speaking of kickbacks, majorityreportkickback.com. Majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the Amazon link. If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through that link. We get a kickback. You can also bookmark it and always buy your Amazon stuff. You'll notice no difference. It costs you nothing. It means absolutely nothing but for the fact that we get a kickback. Thus, majorityreportkickback.com. 646-257-3920 is the number. We'll be right back after this.